So I have this fan in my window that's supposed to bring the air in. If it's a bit cooler outside, it makes a huge difference. If it's not cooler outside, it's really just blowing in more hot air. The heat has a weird way of making you feel really sleepy, but also nauseous. So like, for instance, on Friday when I went home, it was really hot and I was really tired and I took a nap and I just kind of kept waking up from this nap feeling really sick, but tired. And I was like in a daze for like an hour. And eventually I just had to get up and take a freezing cold shower. And even that freezing cold shower didn't feel cold because I was so hot. Everything inside of me was just like needed to be cooled down.
What did you end up doing?
I did not stay home that weekend. I went to my boyfriend's place who has air conditioning. That's usually what I do. Or my parents' place.
There you go.
Heat warnings blanket areas of Ontario, Quebec, and Newfoundland and Labrador this hour from...
Well, a heat wave in Canada is being blamed for at least 70 deaths.
It is going to be muggy tonight, tomorrow, tomorrow night, Monday, and Monday
night. Public health officials are cautioning those especially vulnerable to extreme heat to be extra careful.
I'm lucky. I have air conditioning. It's included in my condo fees. I can use as much of it as I want. And believe me, I do, even though it's making the problem worse. But people who don't have air conditioning, people like our producer, Claire Brassard, who you heard earlier, I don't even know how they live some of these days. And Claire is a healthy young woman, and she can't live in her apartment when the heat gets really bad. There are thousands of less healthy people with the same problem. And a lot of those people are isolated, and they are in real danger every time the temperature spikes. And you probably knew this one was coming, but it's also happening more frequently. Much more frequently. Solutions to climate change are nice to think about, and they are worth chasing, but they don't matter here. A certain amount of temperature increase is already baked into this scenario, so even if we magic our way out of this hell tomorrow, we're still going to have to live with heat. So what does that do to our bodies? And what do we do about that? How do we prepare? Not just individually, but how do we prepare our infrastructure, our social programs, our public policy, to deal with a world where it's going to be a lot hotter than humans are ready for. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dr. Blair Feltmate is the head of the Intact Center on Climate Adaptation at the University of Waterloo. Hi, Blair. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first, because... I think maybe we don't quantify it the right way sometimes. What is a heat wave, and how do we get this description right technically?
Yeah, there is no universally agreed upon definition of heat wave, but as a general rule of thumb, we're talking about 3 days in a row where the temperature doesn't drop below 30 degrees Celsius, day or night.
Right. Do we often get that right when you see it reported in the media or, you know, mentioned casually in conversation?
Probably not so much casually in conversation. People don't stick to the technical definition right. of it. They really mean it's going to be real hot for the next few days.
Mm-hmm. Does it qualify as extreme weather in the same category as hurricanes, flooding, etc.?
Yes. In my opinion, it does. Flooding is the number one cost in Canada by far due to climate change, the expression of extreme weather events. We have more frequency with fires in the country now, driven in, certainly in part at least due to climate change, but extreme heat is certainly driven by climate change, and things are going to get a lot hotter, a lot quicker in this country going forward due to climate change.
Do you think we understand that association as well as some other places in the world, given that we have such a culture of it's so cold here and, you know, the winter is Canada's time, and then when it gets hot, we should just be grateful that it's hot?
Yeah, there probably is a little bit of that, but I think, though, in the last few years. For example, last July in Quebec, as you well know, we had over 60 people die during an extreme heat event. So I think the magnitude of these events now and the negative consequences associated with them, that certainly is drawing more attention in the country, that things are unusual.
Over the past few years, what kind of increase have we seen in terms of heat waves specifically?
Well, we don't have really good data on heat waves specifically. We have data on heat itself.
Right.
And Canada is up about 1.7 degrees Celsius warmer on average over the period of the last 70 years. And Canada is heating at two times the rate of the global average. And indeed, the further north you go in the country, the disproportionately warmer it's getting relative to background where they were pre-industrial revolution, so to speak. But we've done some pretty good modeling. So, for example, here in southern Ontario, in reference to heat, what the predictions are that right now, for example, we have about 20 to 22 days per summer in southern Ontario where the heat exceeds 30 degrees Celsius. By 2040-45, that will go to 60 to 65 days. Our maximum daily temperature right now in this southern Ontario region is about 37 degrees Celsius. In 25, 30 years from now, that will go to 42 to 44 degrees Celsius. And right now, we experience on average of about 0.6, 0.5 heat waves per summer. In other words, again, 3 days in a row where the temperature doesn't drop below 30 degrees Celsius. In 20 to 25 years from now, in 2040-45, that will go to 2 to 2.5 heat waves per summer. So things are getting a lot hotter quickly.
How do we adapt to that?
There's a lot of things we can do. There's physical adaptation and there's behavioral adaptation. For example, the vulnerability on the physical side of the equation, where I personally think there's great risk, is and I'll just use the example of Toronto for the moment, but you could extrapolate to various other cities
and we'll talk about the swath across the country in a moment. But
sure.
If you want to go with Toronto,
let me give you just one example. But you know, quite frankly, the numbers wouldn't be that far off for a Calgary or whatever if you adjust for population. But for example, here in Toronto, we have about 500,000 people living in apartment buildings that are 8 stories and higher that are more than 30 years old in terms of age. And 95% of these buildings do not have central air conditioning, and only 1/3 of them have backup electricity generating capacity to run the building in the event that there's an electricity outage. So this is a recipe for disaster because, first of all, these buildings are hot to begin with, these old-style buildings. And if it's hot outdoors, it's really hot indoors. But let's say we had an electricity outage during a heat wave. That means, first of all, water doesn't go above the 6th or 7th floor in a building when the pumps don't run for the building under city pressure. It won't go above the 6th or 7th floor. So you could have people up on the 15th or 20th floor, if not higher, during a heat wave that A, don't have access to water. B, if they don't have backup generation to drive the elevators, it means people have no way out. They're up there stuck without a way out, particularly if it's an older, let's say you have an older couple in their 80s on a walker. How do they get down 20 floors?
Right.
Or you've got a single parent with a whole bunch of kids trying to take care of. So they can be up there without water and without air conditioning capacity combined with no ability to get out. So this is a very dangerous situation. So in terms of how do we adapt, one situation is to focus on ensuring that we have backup generation to run pumps and elevators to give people, first of all, water in the event of an outage, access to at least an ability to run fans for X period of days, and then a way out of the building by way of elevators.
For people like that, how long does it take in a heat wave for them to be in danger?
It can be a very short period of time, and there are different classifications of people with vulnerability. For example, the elderly, people with pre-existing respiratory conditions, this can be problematic for them. The very young, and also homeless are quite vulnerable to these conditions. So what we want to do, and within a day or so of an extreme heat wave, it can become problematic for these people that to the point of dangerous. And what we want to do by way of adaptation is set up systems using the social NGOs to identify before a heat wave would ever occur, where are these people? Where are they distributed? Where do they live? And then make sure we have a system of people set up to check on these people, these vulnerable people, on a regular basis during a heat wave, knocking on doors and literally saying, are you okay? Do you need to go to a cooling center? Do you have adequate water? Do you have a fan? Do I need to take you to a cooling center to help you out? But we want to put these systems in place to make sure that we're not simply going and knocking on a door 4 days after a heat wave and finding somebody in the extreme condition of suffering from heat.
What about people who are in the same situation you described but are young and healthy, like Claire, our producer, who was talking to us earlier about how she's in that exact situation. You know, she's on a higher floor of an apartment building, no central air, no air conditioner. How long does it take for them to be in danger? Are they in the same amount of danger?
They're not in the same amount of danger, but after 2 to 3 days of consistent heat, it can be problematic. But if you're young and healthy, generally speaking, you can go out. You can get somewhere to cool down. You may go to a cooling center in the basement of the building. They might have one cool room if they don't have central air or mm-hmm. even window air conditioners. You can go to a cooling center. You can go to a shopping mall that might be cooled down and so forth. But it's the people that are more in the conditions whereby it's not so easy for them to get out and get to a place to cool down. They can find themselves in harm's way pretty quickly.
How important is it for temperatures to come down at night, and are they still doing that?
Temperatures come down at night, but increasingly so, as I mentioned earlier, we are going to get more and more heat waves where it is still going to be persistently hot at night. It may be not as hot as it was during the day, but still problematically hot. And the modeling we've done on this shows quite clearly that, you know, the extent and duration of these heat waves is going to be more problematic going forward. So we need to prepare, and we need to prepare quickly. Plus, within cities where 80% of Canadians live, we also get a heat island effect. Cities can be 1 to 3 degrees Celsius beyond just normal ambient heat wave just driven by the city itself. For example, there's dark surfaces within cities. The roofs of buildings tend to be dark. So when sunlight hits these dark surfaces, it doesn't bounce back up into space or radiate back up into space. The energy stays in the system at ground level because the dark surface absorbs that sunlight, and that contributes to heating. So one of the things we want to build into play more and more and more is to ensure that we have cool roofs, which are basically dark roofs painted white to reflect sunlight back into space. And that will produce a cooling effect. We want to ensure that we maintain the tree canopy within cities because that also helps create shade and produces a cooling effect. So there's a lot of things we can do, you know, behaviorally, structurally within buildings themselves, outside within the surrounding communities. And then we also want to make sure that people, from a personal perspective, they remain hydrated. They adjust the time of day at which they work. They, you know, particularly if they work outdoors, they might want to start earlier in the morning and end at noon before the real heat kicks in. They want to wear much lighter clothing. Right now, I'm sitting in the studio with a suit and tie on, and this is about the worst you can do in reference to a heat wave. You don't want to dress like this. You want to keep light and cool. So
you were coming on the radio too. You didn't need to wear a suit and tie.
Well, there you go. And but even that's an issue because it's habit forming. So, you know, for someone who even has a reasonable degree of understanding of this challenge, I'm in a behavioral mode where I almost automatically put on a suit and tie. So we've got to, I have to get past that.
How do we snap people out of that?
I think what's going to happen, and we see it with the manifestation of extreme weather events in lots of regions of the Canada, whether it's flooding or fires or heat waves or sea level rise in the coastal regions and so forth, increasingly so, and you see this in the media all the time, the frequency with which these extreme weather events are manifesting themselves is certainly on the increase. And I think as a result of that, Canadians are coming to the realization that, look, at, you know, there is a change here that has happened and seems to be continuing to happen, and therefore we better adapt, and we better adapt fairly rapidly.
You mentioned some of the things we can do to our infrastructure to better prepare. But in the meantime, what are these extended periods of heat doing to our existing infrastructure? Are we built for this?
No, not really. For example, just with road surfacing, the pavement, we can see pavement buckling under extreme heat. And so from a structural perspective, have we put the expansion joints in place to allow for the heat? Rail lines can expand under heat conditions and cause a buckling and a destabilization for railways traveling on rail. So in Canada's north, it's probably where we see the greatest manifestation of problems due to heat, maybe not a heat wave, but heat in and of itself, because permanently frozen ground, permafrost in Canada's north, is thawing out, it's literally, and it's melting. And this is causing tremendous problems for in reference to the structural integrity of buildings in the north, where they're literally tipping over. They're falling over
because they're built on permafrost.
Yeah, they were built assuming that ground was going to be rock solid year round, and now it's thawing out, and the stilts that are sitting on that ground are now tipping over. In airports in the north, it is very problematic with runways that are almost realizing the equivalent of sinkholes in runways as the ground thaws and the permafrost comes out of the ground. Runways are collapsing, so the manifestation of heat, particularly in the north, which in areas of Canada's north, we're heating at 3 to 4 times the global average.
Right.
This is very, very problematic.
What about, so we've talked about cities mostly. What about rural areas and in particular agriculture? Because there's one aspect of this that I do hear sometimes that more fertile land will become available in Canada. And maybe this is the one positive thing out of climate change.
Yeah. So you can talk to, for example, potato farmers in Alberta. And they will, you know, very often, or not very often, sometimes make the case that they may be able to get one more crop out per season mm-hmm. with a little bit extended extension in the temperature. There are bits and pieces of manifestation of a positive here and there in right. reference to heat. But by and large, the negatives vastly outweigh the positives because our infrastructure is designed for a certain heat structure element. And you even see the industries having to adjust to heat now that you might not otherwise think of. For example, Whistler. Almost everybody in the country is familiar with mm-hmm. Whistler, whether they've been there or not, but a popular ski resort. Whistler is now 1.6 degrees Celsius warmer today on average temperature than it was 100 years ago, and they're getting 20% less snowfall. So they're actually having to adjust the business model of Whistler to take into account mountain biking and hiking and other attractors to bring people into that region because the duration of season and accessibility to go skiing is being diminished due to climate change.
How have other places in the world where it's this hot a lot of the time learned to cope with this?
Well, they learned to cope through behavioral modification and time of day at which they work, the clothing they wear. They try to have cooling facilities in certain facilities, but not always. But in various places around the world, and right now with the heat waves in Europe, we also have situations where large numbers of people are actually dying during mm-hmm. these extreme heat events. So are we adapting? The answer is yes. Or are we adapting fast enough? Probably the answer is no.
Do you find that it's easier to convince them that the extreme weather manifestations of heat waves are connected to climate change than it is with, say, tornadoes and hurricanes and flooding, which there's still an argument in popular culture about how much of that can be attributed to climate change?
By and large, relative to the manifestation of extreme weather risk, whether it's a heat wave or a flood or a fire or whatever the factor may be, I find for the general population, you have to experience it once or maybe twice before you realize that or have the sensation that this is probably real and something different. I work a great deal, for example, in reference to working to mitigate flood risk in the country. Mm-hmm. And I find in cities and communities, if they get flooded out once, they might kind of get hit hard. They might take that as, well, that was just a one-off. But if they get 2 1-in-100-year storms in a 5-year period, all of a sudden they start to get religion on the file and think, oh, there really is something going on here and we have to act. So what we've got to do, we've got to get smarter than that. And we've got to anticipate the change that we know for sure is coming. And by the way, climate change is real. It has happened, is happening, and it's irreversible. It's here to stay, period. There's nothing we can do to stop climate change. We can slow it down, but we can't stop it. So we've got to transition into thinking ahead of the curve on preparedness relative to adaptation. And one of the limitations, quite frankly, in Canada has been that up until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, 95% of the discussion on climate change in this country was on carbon pricing, mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. Should we have a cap and trade system or a carbon tax? And that really drew down probably 97% of the discussion about climate change was on pricing carbon risk. And I'm fully in favor of mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. But what almost never got discussed was adaptation to the extreme weather that's on the ground today, which is more extreme than it was 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and that's going to get more extreme in the future going forward. So should we be talking about mitigating greenhouse gas emissions? The answer is yes, but not exclusively. We should be focusing on adaptation. Adapting to extreme weather events should be 50% of our discussion on how we deal with climate change and then operationalizing the measures to put in place to mitigate the risk. And by the way, a lot of people think sometimes that adapting to extreme weather risk, well, this is going to be really costly. But quite frankly, when you're building new structures the first time or you have a scheduled retrofit, it costs almost the same amount of money to build something right under the umbrella of adaptation to climate change versus building it wrong. But if you build it wrong and then have to retrofit, it's enormously expensive. So this is something that I think we have to understand as a country, that this is a non-negotiable proposition, adapting to extreme weather risk.
One of the last things I want to ask you is, you mentioned way back at the beginning of our discussion about what your modeling would say about number of days above 30 degrees by 2040, 2045. How much of that is already based on what's baked in to climate change now, regardless of what we do 5 years down the road? And how much room is there still for it to get worse?
effectively, the numbers I described relative to escalated heating, they're baked into the system. Probably not the best word to use, but maybe it is the best word to use.
Right.
You know, they are baked into the system. And sometimes people will look at Canada and other countries being signatories, for example, to the Paris Accord, which is a good thing, which I'm in favor of the Paris Accord. And I'm glad that we signed. But the reality of the situation globally is this, and I'm back not too long ago, maybe 2 months ago, speaking to the UN G20 climate group in Argentina on this whole topic of climate change. And what I found there was that for countries that were signatories to the Paris Accord, they all said more or less the following. And this is why I'm saying that extreme heat is not going to go away anytime soon or other forms of expression of climate change. Virtually what all the G20 countries said is that we will work to embrace energy efficiency. We will work to embrace renewable power. We will work to lower or mitigate our carbon footprint. But we will do so at our own pace, with our own verification, and at a rate at which does not negatively impact our economies.
A lot of qualifications.
In other words, they're not going to live up to the Paris Accord. Virtually none of these countries are going to meet their commitments. Everybody gets very upset at the United States for pulling out. But even for the ones who stayed in, they're not going to meet their commitments, number one. And the reality is, and I was just looking at the numbers from the International Energy Agency, right now on this planet, about 80 to 81% of world energy supply at this moment comes from about a third, coal, oil, natural gas. That's where we get our energy on the planet. Three fossil fuel-based sources that when they're burnt, they release CO2 in the atmosphere, which drives more warming, more climate change. By 2040, and these are recent numbers from the International Energy Agency, and even if they're off by a percent or two in their calculations, really makes no difference, it will still be 80 to 81% of world energy supply will come from a third, coal, oil, and natural gas. But the carbon footprint by 2040 will be collectively about 12 to 15% greater than it is today. And that will be, and that's driven through population growth on the planet, just
right.
More people on the planet. The world's many people don't realize the world's net population changes on a per hour basis by 11,000 people per hour. If you subtract deaths from births every single hour, there's 11,000 more people on the planet, which translates through to 95 million more people on the planet per year, which means another 1.2 to 1.5 billion people on the planet by 2030-35. And those people require energy. And a great percentage of that energy, based on IEA projections, is going to come from fossil fuels. And indeed, recently when I sat with the chief climate delegate from India over lunch, she made the following point to me. She said, Blair, in my country right now, we have between 300 and 350 million people who don't have access to fresh water and they don't have access to electricity. By 2026, 2027, three quarters of those people will have access to electricity, and three quarters of that electricity supply will come from coal-fired electricity generation, period, without offsetting those gases.
Right.
So I'm not trying to be alarmist. I'm just saying this is the reality that's on the table, and we really, really need to prepare for extreme heat, floods, fires, sea level rise, permafrost loss, particularly, you know, obviously in northern regions. And the single biggest problem we have in Canada right now on the climate file, by far, is complacency. We think we have the luxury of time, and we do not have it. Every day we don't adapt is a day we don't have. And we have to move much, much, much quicker on this file than we currently are.
So work on reversing it over the long term, but adapt right now.
That's exactly. And adapt rapidly. Work on reversals and adapt. Work on mitigating greenhouse gas emissions, but adapt to the extreme weather that's on the ground right now.
Thank you, Blair.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Blair Feltmate, head of the Intact Center for Climate Adaptation, the University of Waterloo. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca, or you can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can find all our other podcasts on frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get them. On Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. We're there. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.